Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. I'm joined by colorist Jet Omashebi. With nearly 30 years in the industry, Jet has worked on a vast array of projects during this time, from music videos to commercials to TV and films. She's also worked at a number of post houses in London and across Europe, and she is currently the senior colorist for Goldcrest Films, based in London's Soho. Recent projects she's worked on are director Danny Boyle's Trust, a drama series that follows the kidnapping of Paul Getty Sr.'s grandson. Released by FX in 2018, it is set in the UK and Italy and had a contrast of opulence and grunge. She was also the colourist on the BBC's The Little Drummer Girl, based on Jean Le Carré's book of the same title, released last year and directed by Park Chan-wook. The series unfolds an espionage thriller set in the 1970s. And she was also the colourist on the multi-award winning The Night Manager, also produced by The Beeb and is another Le Carré novel directed by Susan Beer. Released in 2016, the story follows a night manager of a hotel who is recruited as a spy whose target is a prominent arms dealer. The narrative winds its way through UK, Switzerland, Egypt and Istanbul. Jet's contribution to the many TV series and films is far too great to list on this introduction. So here is a quick whiz through a handful more. TV series Life on Mars, A Very English Scandal, Luther, Line of Duty and Emma, and films Underworld, King Charles III, and Barbarian Sound Studio. Jet has won a Royal Television Society Award, a Women in Film and TV Craft Award, and has been voted number one colourist in the industry's highly regarded Televisual VFX poll. Jet herself has been a judge on a number of award panels, and is a regular speaker in both the industry and educational forums. Not only have I been super keen to have a colourist on the podcast, there have been a number of other guests who have asked to know more about what it is a colourist does. So I'm super excited to welcome one of London's top colourists to the podcast. Jet, it's great to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm wondering if we can start. There's often, I would say, colourists, there's a bit of a mystery about what they do. So could you describe to me what a colourist is and what it is that you do?
It is a bit of a black art, and the job has kind of evolved, and I'll give you a tiny bit of background so you can sort of see how it's changed. But it used to be lab-based, so when things were all shot on film, in order to be able to show that film, you had to make a print. And in order to be able to make a print, you had to have somebody who would go through and kind of grade that print. And then when film started to be shown on the television, there had to be a way to kind of make this real sort of physical hard copy into electronics. And so the colorist or telecine operator, as we were in those days, sort of became, you were wrangling this film and changing it into video space. And through there, you were again trying to make things have continuity and look nice and look sharp. And it was a very, very technical job. And it was kind of normally done by men, if, normally, in white coats with kind of screwdrivers and tweakers. And it was a purely mechanical process. And over the years, it's become more and more artistic. As we can do more, we're now in a digital age, and people realised that we could take a lot of the lab processes away and move them into an electronic domain. And of course, now very few things are shot on film anyway. So what I do, 50% of my job is making things look even. Things are shot on different cameras in different locations. And so when you edit that story together, it's a way of making everything look even and continuous so that you can stay in the story, because you're then able to shape the story in a sort of colour script, if you like, and you can actually manipulate people's emotions through colour.
And the term online grader and colourist is often interchangeable. Is there a difference? Is it a similar role? Is it the exact same role?
I don't want to take anything away from online editors who do colour correct, but I think there is a difference between, like I said, the corrective element of the job, which is making things match and look continuous, and the actual artistic side of the job, where somebody is shooting a film set in the 70s and they want it to look like a certain film stock. I think those are the sort of things that a colourist gets asked to do more and more, whereas perhaps not so much an online editor. I suppose an online editor would possibly look for a plug-in or look for an look for a slightly different way to do it, whereas a colourist will build it from scratch. So I think all these terms are becoming very interchangeable in a way. I mean, I think we're all able to multi-skill, and the equipment certainly allows us to. So I don't think the difference is as great as it once might have been.
I just want to pick up on something you said there when you're talking about colourists building it from scratch. Could you explain that a little bit more?
So I suppose one of the first things that I would do is sit down with a director or a DOP and find out exactly what it is they want. What are their references? You know, what have they seen before? Or what's the emotional tone? When is it set? So all of those questions. And from that, you can get an idea of how they want something to look. Mm-hmm. And then it's a question of looking at their footage and working out how you can bring those kind of tones to it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's possible and sometimes it's not. And sometimes you get some happy accidents along the way. Mm-hmm. But it is very much a question of, well, how can I bring all of these different elements that they're asking for together? You know, do we, for instance, if it's a period piece, you know, do we emulate an old film we've seen? Do we look at some stock emulation that we want to use? Do we put grain on? Mm-hmm. Do we take colour away? Do we push more colours? People quite often ask for a Technicolor look, and then you have to find a way to reduce the colour palette in a way, because Technicolor was very colourful, but only in certain colours, and a lot of it was very muted. So those are the sort of things that you might be asked to do as a colourist.
So I'm wondering if you could tell me, what was your journey? What was the path to becoming a colourist to where you are now?
So I was very interested in sound as a youngster, and I had done some radio actually at school, so I was quite interested in radio. But I didn't have a degree, so for various reasons I left school before I got to university, and I went to see the BBC. They had a scheme actually, which allowed you to trail one of their producers, and I did. And they said, you know, great, you know, we really like you, but we only employ graduates. Mm. At that time, they only employed graduates. And I was like, right, I better get a degree then. But I didn't. I realised that getting a degree was going to take quite a long time. Yeah. So in the meanwhile, I actually enrolled into my local college, which had a very broad media course. Mm-hmm. And I realised pretty quickly that it wasn't going to be very good. But what they did have was they had a programme of work placements, holiday work placements, work experience. And I did see the value in that. So I did that. And I managed to get into a sound company doing post-production sound just on a two-week placement, unpaid. And they offered me a job. At the end of that, they offered me a job as a receptionist. And I had to really think about whether dropping out of college was going to be the right thing to do, or whether it's just to jump into this job, get my foot in the door and kind of beat some doors down. And so I decided that the thug approach was going to be better for me. And so I did. I went to work as a receptionist, and then I was in bookings, and then I worked my way into the technical department as a sound assistant. And I was actually the first woman they'd ever employed in an operational capacity. It was tough, you know. Not everyone was welcoming, and in the end they said they didn't think I was suitable for doing anything technical and should probably go and get some typing speed up and do something clerical. Which is actually turned out to be the best advice, because I was really angry and thought, well, I'll show you. You know, I'll show you. I camped out at the union office, which was in Wardour Street at that point, and I just applied for every job I could find that was in any way to do with post-production and production. And I've still got a big file at home with every single rejection letter I got, and there were lots of them. I think there's about 60.
That is persistent.
Yeah. I was angry.
Yeah. Good.
I got two jobs, actually. One was another scheme that Channel 4 were running, called JobFit. But I also went for an interview at a facility called Rush's, which have closed now, unfortunately, And they did post-production for commercials. And I was so jazzed by it. I could just see all these people running around doing all these kind of creative things. And I was so excited. And I said, look, I don't know what you do here, but I really like it. And I'd really like to get in, you know, will you employ me? And they did. So it was just serendipity, really, that I got into pictures because they didn't do sound.
Yeah.
And wandered into the grading suite one day, and there was lots of film lying around, and I just picked it up, and they could see that I could handle film, and they were amazed because they were all, you know, they all came from video, and they were like, oh my goodness, you know what to do with film. Come and join us, you know, come and join our gang. And I did, and I loved it. I didn't know that job existed, but I was fascinated from the start. And I was an assistant for a long time.
Uh-huh.
You know, first there in the morning, last to leave at night.
Yeah.
4 years, really. And then I started to get my own jobs slowly, just odd, cheap, low-budget promos, and just really went from there. And it was a very slow-moving career, really, because you have to build your client base, and it takes a long time. And then I moved around as well. I kind of moved different companies, and I think that helped me a lot. To just, you know, get more experience, get more confidence, get more clients.
I guess as well that moving around, you get to work with different types of people as well, learning different maybe thought processes or approaches.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also different equipment. There's no real formal training when I came up.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of had to dive in and learn different things and learn different ways of doing things with the equipment you had. There was no standardisation that there is now. So moving around kind of enabled me to learn stuff too.
And then what was it moving up the ranks and learning how to be a colourist?
You know, there's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of sitting watching.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of shining. You need to go somewhere and shine and become indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something else I say to people a lot, you know, be there, be engaged, be interested and shine, because that's really, people will always want you around.
Mm-hmm.
It's a team game. But actually being keen and being interested and engaged, that's more difficult. And it is very boring and it's long hours. And unless you love it, you won't be able to do it, really.
What is the technical workflow?
The workflow is quite interesting, and actually it's ever-changing as technology changes. It used to be very linear. You would have offline, then it would come to... then it would come to me, go to conform, to be conformed, then it would come to me, and then it would go on. Now things tend to overlap, and you find that a project is pretty much live throughout facility.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cut in offline. We then conform it.
Mm-hmm.
And really from that point, online and grading might be happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So projects will be bouncing backwards and forwards and be live really right until the end.
Mm-hmm.
Effects will come in at some point and they'll be put in, which I will also then go back and grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then now there are a whole plethora of different delivery formats, from DCPs for cinema. Different territories will have different deliveries. Some will have commercial breaks, some won't.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be different size files. So that also you have to take into all the consideration that all happens at the end.
When you're colouring either a commercial or music video or film or a series, who do you work with?
It tends to be that the director and the cameraman, DOP, will come. Quite often the producer.
Mm-hmm.
Producers these days, there's lots of co-productions, so there's lots of producers. They don't all stay around for the whole time, but generally you are attended by somebody creative.
And so what is your process? So after having discussions, and do those discussions happen before they go and shoot things? Or do they happen generally when they've shot things and then they come and have a chat to you? And then once you've had that conversation, how do you go about thinking about it, researching ideas, pulling references?
Well, in an ideal world, you would be part of the pre-production. So as soon as the DOP is engaged, he, she would come and speak with me about the idea and shoot some tests, some lens tests, some camera tests, and then maybe even some costume and makeup tests, depending how far along they are, but certainly some camera tests. Come back to me, and then we look at those tests and start talking about how we want that to look.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a wonderful job called In Plain Sight, and the DOP really wanted to have a very Saul Leiter, was his reference. Mm-hmm. He brought some pictures along. And so we worked on that with the tests, and I was able to come up with a lookup table.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a lookup table, which he was then able to use.
This might be a really stupid question, but what is a lookup table?
That's a, you have a podcast on lookup tables on their own. A lookup table is basically a way of emulating
mm-hmm.
what something will look like from one medium to another. So the camera, in this case, I think, if my memory serves me right, was an Arri Alexa, will capture in a format called Log-C. You can't look at Log-C, it doesn't look very impressive. Mm-hmm. So you need a way to translate to what that's going to look like mm-hmm. on a television screen or in the cinema. Mm-hmm. And so you use what's called a lookup table, and it's just a conversion table, which tells you how that signal is going to behave mm-hmm. once you put it on a target.
So you've had that discussion, yeah. you might create a lookup table, yeah. And then they go out and they shoot the reel there, and you get the offline edit, so it's yes. been put together.
Yes, and sometimes if you're lucky, you'll get to look at some rushes along the way if you have time. And, you know, usually before they come back in, you'll have another session with them,
mm-hmm.
What I call a play date,
mm-hmm.
where you literally just have a look at odd scenes. They don't need to be cut together.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you'll see if the lookup table's working, or you'll have some different ideas, or the idea might have changed or grown. And so you'll have another kind of just play around to see how that's working. And then they come in generally for the session once the conform is done.
So what's your immediate team?
We're very, very fortunate. We have a super colour scientist. And I don't know how one would become a colour scientist, because it's very, very specialised. But yes, it is a real job.
Mm-hmm. And what does a colour scientist do?
A colour scientist basically understands how colour is reproduced on lots of different targets. Mm-hmm. So whether it's cinema, whether it's television, and can design lookup tables that we talked about to make that process as accurate as possible. You're taking one thing and you're trying to make it look the same in a different place.
Mm.
And so a colour scientist understands how to do that. And they're like wizards, they're like Gandalf, and they basically have their own proprietary way of doing these things. Mm.
Okay, so there's the colour scientist that you will yeah. interact with, and then who else is on your immediate team?
Oh, okay, so I mean, I have amazing amount of support. I have an assistant
mm-hmm.
who I rely on a lot for preparing the jobs,
mm-hmm.
checking them, making sure there were no shots missing,
mm-hmm.
that it's all set up in the right colour space,
mm-hmm.
so we know exactly what resolution it is and where it's going to end up. And then there's data IO, who makes sure that any shots that are coming in from other places, i.e. Effects houses,
mm-hmm.
come in and are transcoded into the right format again mm-hmm. and put on your timeline. So you know there's a whole group of support really
mm-hmm.
To make sure that everything, I mean, it's, you know, it's vastly complicated mm-hmm. and getting more and more complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people assume that colourist kind of sits around and plays with light all day, but actually there's an awful lot of pixel wrangling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the subtleties versus kind of purposely stylized colour palettes and how that plays out on the visual narrative.
I think that highly stylized grades certainly have their place, but it very much depends on the content. I think if you notice it, then you have to notice it for a reason. So if it serves the story,
mm-hmm.
then I think a very stylized look is great. If it takes you away or it takes you out of the story, then it's not really working.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you have to do what fits. For example, if I think of something highly stylized, I think of something like Utopia, which was out on Channel 4 a while back, and that's, you know, extremely stylized look, which suits that perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you try to apply that to something like Call the Midwife,
mm-hmm.
it would take you out of that story,
yeah.
you know. So everything has to be in service of the story, really.
And how important is colour on the visual narrative for someone who works in it day in and day out?
I think you can use colour, you know, to almost as its own script. I think colour and music are quite similar in the way that they kind of manipulate your emotions without you really understanding what's going on. So I always feel that you can help a viewer navigate through a script using colour in very subtle ways that just helps give another dimension. So it's not just words, it's emotions, and you guide them through the narrative in an emotional kind of subliminal way, really. In the same way that sound does that very thing, I think.
And so where do you go for your research and references?
Well, I watch a lot of movies, go to a lot of exhibitions, look at a lot of photography, and also a lot of life, really. You know, you can go through the park and see how light's working and what happens in autumn and where the sun is in summer, and that all of those things are all great references.
What skills would you say were essential to being a colourist?
So I think not everyone's the same, not everyone has the same approach. I would have said that a lot of empathy and a lot of listening and an ability to really understand something in a short amount of time, because you're kind of the last person to the project. And so I have to play catch up pretty fast in terms of understanding exactly where this project is now and what people expect from it. So that being able to key into people quite quickly, you know, that's sort of what I think is a good skill. Different people attract what they need. I tend to be quite empathetic, listen. I really want to know about the project. I want to be inside the project. I'm not really approaching it from a sort of a technical standpoint. I want to know where the emotional emphasis is. And it's long hours, so you have to love it, really. It's long hours in the dark. So you do have to love it. Yeah.
Are they long hours, like, on jobs as they're kind of going through?
They are. It's a bit like casino time when you're in the grade, because it's dark and you're not always aware of how long, and it's very absorbing. But we're always working to quite tight deadlines. So we normally have sort of 3 to 5 days for one episode, depending on how complex it is. We are really working to a deadline.
Can you talk about maybe one of the biggest challenges you faced in your career?
I think the ongoing challenge is that there's no tick. There's no right way to do my job. You're always wondering whether somebody else could have got a better result than you. That's always in the back of your mind. You know, could this have been better if someone else had done it? Or would a different approach been better? And we don't generally get a chance to try lots of different approaches. You know, that's a really luxury of time. So that's why I try and do as much prep as I do. And there are going to be some people that you just don't get along with. And that for whatever reason, that just doesn't work. Those are the ongoing challenges. Starting out, I think being one of the few women to do my job, especially being a woman of colour, I think that was a challenge, because people just didn't expect to see me in the seat. They'd come into the room and they'd be looking, they'd think I was there just to set up for someone. And if I had a male assistant, they would very, very often direct their comments to him, which, you know, I understand. Sort of breaking that was quite difficult. So I took quite a humorous approach to that, and I always dressed in a suit when I was starting out.
Yeah.
And not a skirt suit. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, a boyfriend of mine said, "Why do you go to work dressed as a cop?" you know, I kind of made it so that people knew who was in charge.
Yeah.
And that sort of worked for me, and also worked for my own confidence. But there needed to be a visual reference, like, I'm the one in the suit, you know.
Can I ask you about your observations in relation to the industry, in relation to women? And your experience has over the kind of last 30 years, have you seen a significant change, especially in kind of the colour space of what you do?
Yeah, I have. And I'm immensely proud, actually, if I can just blow some sort of trumpet. But I'm immensely proud that things have changed for women, especially in grading. And if I'm any part of that, then I'm just so happy. I've had a lot of female assistants who've gone on to do great things, and I'm really proud of that. And if just being in that role kind of makes anyone feel that they can do it, then that's kind of worth it. I think most companies have started to realise that it's absolutely fine to employ women, that women are very capable, conscientious, and that actually a group of people, of men and women, make a place work and feel much better.
Yeah.
So I don't think there is the stigma that there was.
Mm.
I think it takes time, and I think there's a way to go, but I think we're definitely going in the right direction. And I think things filter through, and now through the, you know, the Me Too movement, and you know, I think it really is a great time for women because we can sort of talk about it amongst ourselves now in ways that we kind of didn't dare to before. We all kind of knew there was this slight stigma or slight difficulty, but nobody really wanted to talk about it. And now we can go, that was hard, wasn't it? And I go, yeah, that was hard, wasn't it? And you go, good, I wasn't imagining it. That was difficult, yeah. But we, you know. So I think, yeah, it's great. I think we're making great progress.
Can you tell me what you love about your job?
Yeah, I can. I absolutely love being around creative people. I mean, there is just nothing like meeting amazingly talented people who are, you know, doing things with story and with light and VFX. I mean, it's just a joy.
Yeah.
For me, being able to contribute to someone else's project is just, you know, I find that exciting. So I'm a great number two. I really, you know, I don't have the idea, but once someone else has the idea, I've got all the energy to make it happen. So, and the fact that every job I get is different in some way. There's no two jobs that are the same. So every time you start a new job, you're a beginner again. And that's both terrifying and really exciting. So those are the things that I really do love about the job.
What advice would you give to someone setting out to be a colourist?
It's really difficult to get started. So I would say try and look for different routes in. I mean, the conventional route to be a colourist is to go in to a post house as a runner or receptionist, shine like crazy, and get promoted and get as much sort of training as you can. And most post houses are really keen for that to happen, you know. So I would say definitely do that route, but also it's useful if you do as much research as you can, but it's not essential, because actually, like I said before, fitting in is in some ways just as important. Nobody's going to expect you to turn up and be able to do the job, but you will have to put the time in. There's a progression, and that's quite right that there is, because there's a lot to learn.
I'm wondering if you could tell me what projects you've got coming up in the next couple of months.
Yes, got a packed schedule. I'm doing a massive job for Netflix, which I can't talk about.
Okay.
But watch this space, because it's extremely exciting.
Okay. Soon to be released?
It will be released at the end of the year.
Okay.
But so soon to be started. And a lovely wartime drama, which is a six-parter. And another thing, which is a contemporary ish piece, all set in Baghdad, called Baghdad Central.
Can I squeeze in one cheeky extra question? Can you tell me what's been the most favourite thing you've worked on and why?
Oh,
I'm more curious.
Okay.
Because you've worked on a lot of amazing things.
I loved working on Life on Mars, which was, you know, a long time ago now. It was 2007, I think, or 2008. And I just loved it because I was allowed to do something different. I had a lot of input into it.
Yeah.
And everybody was on the same page. I seemed to just do the thing that everybody kind of would have done.
Yeah.
And so that was a very easy process. It was very collaborative and everybody was very sort of positive about it. So that was a lovely job. And I did something last year called The Terror. It's the story of two ships that go off to the Antarctic, get stuck in the ice, and everybody ends up, spoiler, eating each other. And again, that was a very heavy VFX job. So it was all shot against green screen.
Yeah.
And they put in all of the water and the ice effects afterwards. And so, you know, I couldn't really see how it was going to work. But because I was involved from the beginning and setting up the looks and the lookup tables, it all just worked really well, and it all came together to you know, to really look fantastic. So I'm quite happy with that.
Cool. So we're coming to the end of the interview, and something I always ask everyone before they leave is, if You could tell me a career or job in the creative industries that you know little about or you're curious about, and I could try and get someone in there on the podcast, and also another woman in the creative industries that I could get on Greater Than 11%.
Well, one of the fascinating and so underrepresented areas of certainly post-production are engineers. In all my years, I really can only think of one or maybe two female engineers mm-hmm. through the years. I mean, that's, you know, we so rely on these wonderful engineers to plug all of these individual bits of kit together and get them to work mm-hmm. and also understand how they work and keep us running, and they really are the sort of unsung heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, not a typically female job, mm-hmm. but there are, and that fascinates me. How one gets into that and how one survives within that environment.
Yeah. Any other creative women that you'd like to recommend to come on the podcast?
I would love to also hear from any women who made it as dubbing mixers.
Okay.
Where I failed, and you know how that has changed.
Okay.
And you know,
that's a challenge.
Just in case I ever wanted to
go back,
you know. But yeah, no, that would fascinate me also.
Okay, awesome. I'll do my best. Jet, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.